Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Ikawa Tawai and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ربكم تضرعا وخفية صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At least three people are killed and several more injured in fresh Israeli missile strikes on Syria launched from over Lebanon. A U.S. congressional delegation is in Taiwan amid heightened tensions with China following the House Speaker's recent visit to the island. The Russian president calling for expansion of comprehensive relations with North Korea. He says it will strengthen security and stability of the Korean Peninsula. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Israel carries out fresh missile strikes on Syria, targeting areas near the capital Damascus and Tartus, a city on the Mediterranean coast. According to the Syrian military, three people were killed and three others wounded in the strikes hitting the vicinity of Tartus. Syrian air defenses reportedly intercepted some of the incoming missiles. Fresh Israeli air raids were launched from over Lebanon. Israel frequently performs missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has time and again warned against the regime's acts of aggression. The Syrian government also launched official complaints with the UN and other international bodies about the Israeli violations. Okay, for more on that story, let's cross over to Damascus, the Syrian capital city. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, is there. Mohammed, tell us more about what happened.
Yes, Israel carried out attacks on two Syrian cities, Tartus and the Damascus countryside. According to an official military source, at about 8:50 p.m. local time last night, Israel carried out missile strikes on the city of Tartus and also over the Al-Qalamun Mountains on the borderline between Syria and Lebanon and Damascus countryside. The Syrian military source said that some of the enemy missiles were intercepted and shot down by Syria's air defenses. However, it seems some of them did hit some targets in Syria, because three military personnel were killed and three others were injured as a result. Also, the attacks caused material damages. Of course, it is important to say that Israel carried out the attacks from the direction of southeast Beirut. Sometimes Israel uses Lebanese airspace in order to attack Syria. Fighter jets carry out the attacks from that direction. Sometimes it uses the occupied Syrian Golan to launch surface-to-surface missiles. In all situations, Israel is undermining Syria's sovereignty, and this is against international law. And it is believed that this is the 19th Israeli attack on Syria this year. Despite that, all of those attacks, and there is international silence over such attacks. Also, despite all of the Syrian government foreign ministry letters to the United Nations to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security, there is silence, there is no action or condemnation, and the attacks continue.
Okay, thanks for that. Mohammed Ali in Damascus, Syria. A Palestinian man has been killed in yet another Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces shot Mohammed al-Shaham in the head during a raid on his home in the town of Kfar Agab, north of Al-Quds. The regime's military has carried out almost daily raids in different areas of the occupied West Bank over the past month. The attacks frequently lead to deadly violence against Palestinians as they turn out to protest the raids. The Israeli military also launched a three-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip last week, killing dozens of civilians and wounding another 360. Now, today marks the 16th anniversary of Lebanon's victory in its 33-day war against the Tel Aviv regime. The occasion is annually commemorated by holding celebrations, but this year's ceremonies have been postponed due to the Muslim mourning month of Muharram. The 2006 war began with Israeli airstrikes against the Lebanese cities in July and ended by a UN-backed ceasefire. The aggression killed more than 1,200 people, mostly civilians, in Lebanon, and resulted in the demolition of vital infrastructure. Israel also launched a war on Lebanon in the year 2000. On both occasions, however, Hezbollah resistance fighters defeated the Israeli forces, and Tel Aviv was forced to retreat without achieving any of its objectives. A human rights activist, Firas al-Najm, says Lebanon's victory in the 33-day war shattered the myth of Israel's invincibility, breaking new ground for others to follow.
It was a good example, I think, for all the resistance in the region, and especially the Palestinians that are occupied by the Zionist regime. It was a great example that you can defeat the Zionist regime, that the Zionist regime, the way the mainstream media has pictured them as if they're, undefeatable, and they are one of the mightiest armies in the region, and they have the most sophisticated weapons, and they have the most, amount of governments in the world or regimes, you can say, that support them. And, there's no way to defeat them and humiliate them, that they will take over and they will destroy any area. Yes, they did do a lot of destruction in Lebanon, but they were still pushed out of Lebanon and they were humiliated. And at the same time, all their objectives in the 33-day war in 2006 were a failure. They wanted to pull them back behind the river. They wanted to destroy their military infrastructure, Hezbollah's military infrastructure. And they also said that they would release and get those prisoners that Hezbollah captured released without any negotiations and without any losses. But thankfully, all their objectives, the three objectives, main objectives, were all lost, and they lost everything. And they had to pull out, and the United Nations mediated, and they put the UNIFIL forces in between, to stop the war. But at the end of the day, Hezbollah was able to release all the Lebanese prisoners at the end, and they gave them back two dead, as I remember, soldiers, IDF soldiers.
The United States says the five-member congressional delegation is in Taiwan for a meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen amid heightened tensions with China over the island. U.S. Embassy in Taipei says that the meeting will focus on regional security, among other topics. The visit is made nearly 2 weeks after a controversial one, another visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. China considers Taiwan part of its territory and is infuriated with the U.S. meddling in the island's politics. Beijing has conducted at least two military drills near the island since Pelosi's visit. It's warned Washington that any interference in its internal affairs, quote, will collide with a great wall of steel. Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling for expanding bilateral ties with North Korea. In a letter to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, Putin said that the two countries will expand their comprehensive and constructive bilateral relations with common efforts. The Russian president, in his letter to Kim on North Korea's Liberation Day, underlined that it will be in the interests of both Moscow and Pyongyang to form closer bonds. Putin added that the expansion of ties would also be beneficial for the security and stability of the Korean Peninsula and the northeastern Asian region. The North Korean leader also sent a letter to Putin. He welcomed the call and said that their cooperation would frustrate those who prefer threats and provocation. Both countries are currently under crippling Western sanctions. Now, in the meantime, South Korean president proposing a larger-scale aid package for North Korea in return for denuclearization. Yoon Suk-yeol says that Pyongyang abandoning its nukes is essential for peace on the Korean Peninsula. He says that Seoul is ready to help the North modernize its infrastructure if it agrees to the deal. Yoon, who took office earlier this year, has taken up a hard-line approach to Pyongyang. North Korea remains undeterred amid what it calls acts of provocation, including the South's joint military drills with the U.S. Last month, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that his country was ready to mobilize its nuclear weapons in a potential war. Pyongyang has also tested a record number of missiles over the past months. Those include its first intercontinental projectile launch since 2017. Jennifer Chang has provided us with some more details about South Korea's offer for aid package to Pyongyang.
Well, this aid package is not really anything new from what previous South Korean administrations and presidents have offered to the North. So there is virtually no chance that North Korea is going to take up Yoon's offer. Now, Yoon and the U.S. are preparing large-scale military drills, which start next week. And there is fear that the North will conduct provocations. Only a matter of days ago, it threatened a very dangerous move against the South because the South sent balloons and propaganda leaflets into the North, which the North claims to have caused a huge COVID-19 outbreak. A couple of days ago, as I said, they announced this threat, and they also said they had overcome COVID-19. So they are in a position to strike at this whole incident, which caused such suffering in North Korea, including reportedly the infection with COVID-19 of the North's leader, Kim Jong-un. And many experts say they could conduct a nuclear test or a missile test or even border clashes.
Afghanistan marking the first anniversary of the Taliban's return to power and the chaotic withdrawal of the United States following 20 years of occupation. The Taliban have announced Monday a national holiday exactly a year ago. Taliban forces captured Kabul following a blitz offensive against government forces. Afghanistan has seen a rise in attacks against the local Shiite population since the Taliban took power. The country also faces a humanitarian crisis, with aid agencies saying half the entire population is struggling with extreme poverty. Making matters worse is the U.S. freezing nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets. The U.N. and other international bodies have urged Washington to release the funds to allow Afghanistan deal with its crises. In recent years, the United States has fought wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. And those are just the ones that the Pentagon has officially acknowledged. The actual scope of American war-making is much wider. A new research has revealed that the U.S. has undertaken almost 400 military interventions since its founding in 1776 until 2019.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on Earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the U.S., as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the U.S. has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the U.S., the military-industrial complex.
The U.S. has tried to be on the first hand with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby U.S. wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
Now, with no beginning declared and no end in sight, these wars seem to have become the new normal around the globe. And instead of helping build a safer world, the U.S. has chosen to expand its never-ending wars. Apart from causing massive destruction, these military interventions lead to what Washington calls collateral damage, euphemism for all the innocent people killed in war zones.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the U.S. seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The U.S. has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the U.S. military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the U.S. no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the U.S. isn't necessarily in wars. It is, in fact, in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the U.S. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and U.S. foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
You think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course U.S. is an intervention in power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different reason, campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight. In the U.S., Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia wants to impeach Attorney General Merrick Garland over what she says is the political persecution of former President Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ida Sisko. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Marjorie Taylor Greene Seeks to Impeach Garland for Persecuting Trump. In the U.S., Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia wants to impeach Attorney General Merrick Garland over what she says is the political persecution of former President Donald Trump. Marjorie Taylor Greene accused Merrick Garland of endangering, undermining, and compromising the justice system in a resolution calling for his impeachment on Friday, 12th of August. She claims Merrick Garland persecuted Donald Trump by approving of the FBI raid of the former president's Mar-a-Lago home. Greene and other Trump loyalists have been raging since federal agents executed a search warrant at Donald Trump's residence, Mar-a-Lago, earlier this week. The FBI seized multiple boxes of documents, including many that were marked classified and some that reportedly may have included nuclear secrets. What they've been doing to former President Donald Trump is political persecution, Marjorie Taylor Greene told reporters before entering the Capitol to file the impeachment resolution on Friday, 12th of August. Merrick Garland has abused his position of power as the Attorney General to politically persecute President Joe Biden's enemies. And the whole purpose of this is to prevent former President Donald Trump from ever being able to hold office. I'm introducing articles of impeachment on Merrick Garland, she added, because we cannot tolerate this in America, where our great institutions are welded and abused in such a way to impeach people's political enemies. Marjorie Taylor Greene is not the only prominent conservative to call for Merrick Garland's impeachment over the raid. Republican Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky and Josh Hawley of Missouri both suggested impeaching Merrick Garland during Fox News appearances this week. There is little realistic chance of Merrick Garland actually being impeached and removed from office due to a two-thirds majority vote needed for conviction, an unlikely prospect even if Republicans were unanimous and in control of both chambers of Congress following next November's midterm elections. The legal claims made in Marjorie Taylor Greene's impeachment resolution are also questionable at best. While Greene argues that the FBI's raid was political, the agency executed a search warrant that was obtained through a legal and not a political process. The search warrant cited alleged violations of multiple laws against the concealment or taking of official government documents, as well as alleged violations of the Espionage Act. The first of two articles of impeachment that Marjorie Taylor Greene's resolution proposes claims that Garland's personal approval of the search warrant was a blatant attempt to persecute a political opponent. The second proposed article of impeachment claims that Merrick Garland demonstrated a pattern of conduct that is incompatible with his duties as a civil officer of the United States by persecuting Donald Trump over documents he legally declassified. Donald Trump has said that the classified documents removed from his home, Mar-a-Lago, this week were declassified just before he left office, although the former president has not provided any evidence or any proof to back up his statement. Regardless, the documents seized do not have to be classified for Donald Trump to potentially be in violation of multiple statutes cited in the search warrant. Classified documents are also not required to be in violation of the Espionage Act. Donald Trump has also suggested, without evidence, that the FBI may have planted documents at his home. In addition, Donald Trump has claimed that former President Barack Obama violated the Presidential Records Act by taking 33 million pages of classified documents from the White House after leaving office in 2017. However, the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, told the New York Times on Friday that Barack Obama was never in personal possession of official documents after leaving the White House, whether the documents were classified or not. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, said in a statement, "It had assumed exclusive legal and physical custody of Barack Obama's presidential records when President Barack Obama left office in 2017, in accordance with the Presidential Records Act." NARA, or the National Archives and Records Administration, moved approximately 30 million pages of unclassified records to a NARA facility in the Chicago, Illinois area, where they are maintained exclusively by NARA. The statement continued, "Former President Barack Obama has no control over where and how NARA stores the presidential records of his administration." Claims that FBI agents who searched Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate were looking for classified documents concerning nuclear weapons have heated up speculation about the Bureau's extraordinary investigation into the former president. A Washington Post story, which relied on unnamed sources, followed earlier statements published in Newsweek that agents were seeking national defense information, according to two senior government officials. Meanwhile, an exclusive report by Newsweek cited sources in the U.S. intelligence community that said the top-secret materials could contain documents dealing with intelligence sources and intelligence methods, including human sources on the American government payroll. After the FBI raided the former president's Florida residence on Monday, 8th of August, it has remained tight-lipped about its investigation.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the economic crisis India is grappling with, marked by growing trade deficit, currency depreciation, soaring inflation, and fuel shocks. And we shall also take a look at the traditional Muharram commemorations in the Muslim-majority region of Kashmir, as well as the ban on Muharram 8 and 10 processions.
When the coronavirus pandemic struck the subcontinent in the early part of 2020, the Indian economy was already in a downward spiral, with a growth rate plummeting to an 11-year low of 3.1%. The 2 years of pandemic and a series of lockdowns pushed it further down. Today, the world's second most populous country finds itself in the throes of a deep economic crisis marked by a widening trade deficit, depreciation of the national currency, soaring inflation, and oil shocks.
The fiscal year 2022 to 2023 has revealed unprecedented turbulence in India's economic sector, fueled by both internal and external factors. The country's trade deficit expanded to a record $31.02 billion U.S. dollars in July, primarily due to a fall in merchandise exports and a surge in imports. It marks a threefold jump from the $10.63 billion U.S. dollars around the same time last year, according to the preliminary data released by India's Ministry of Commerce and Industry. For the first 4 months of the year, the deficit stood at $100 billion U.S. dollars, up from the $42 billion U.S. dollars in the same period last year. India's national currency, rupee, has also seen depreciation in its value against the U.S. dollar, recording a fall of more than 5% in the last year, fueled by global headwinds and concerns of a widening trade deficit. Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman attributed to external reasons, including the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices, and exacerbation of global financial conditions. The oil price shock has led to rising inflation in all oil-importing countries, including India. According to analysts, oil price risk presents a huge threat to the Indian economy, as supply losses are not likely to result in significant volume risk.
A surge in oil prices in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war has substantially and unmistakably affected the world's third largest consumer of oil, India, which imports 85% of its oil needs. The country's current account deficit is projected to widen to 3.1% of GDP in the financial year 2023 from 1.2% in the current financial year, according to the global lending body, the International Monetary Fund, despite the surge in cheaper crude oil imports from Russia.
India's crude imports from Russia jumped significantly, from almost nothing in January to 300,000 barrels a day in March, 700,000 barrels a day in April, to 1 million barrels a day in June, now accounting for nearly 17% of the country's total oil imports, up from less than 1% before Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Although soaring crude prices may not impact India like other countries, global oil price shocks have traditionally caused depreciation in the rupee and an increase in the country's import bill. The soaring global energy prices have had knock-on effects on the rupee, with the Indian currency recording a drop of more than 5% against the U.S. dollar year-to-date. The turbulence in the global energy market and rising prices are particularly challenging for India, as it pays for oil in dollars. When the rupee depreciates, the country's oil purchases also become expensive. According to analysts at Nomura, for every $1 hike in the oil price, India's import bill swells by $2.1 billion. The fall in the rupee in turn also fuels inflation and bloats account deficit. The annual inflation rate in India surged to 7.8% in April 2022, the highest figure in almost 8 years.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Akash Goglani, public policy researcher from New Delhi. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Goglani. Despite the rebound from the coronavirus pandemic, the Indian economy is still tottering below the pre-COVID trajectory. How and which sectors did the 2 years of pandemic hit the hardest?
Thank you, Mehdi, for the questions, and thank you for inviting me on the show. As you can see, across the world during the pandemic, the most effective sectors were the contact-based sectors, where there was a lot of human contact. In India also, you can say, I could name five sectors. One was obviously hospitality sector, people were not traveling. The other was tourism. Tourism contributes 7% of GDP in India. That was one of the major sectors. India also relies on very high, let's say, internal migration. So because you had labor markets disrupted with lockdowns, so 21 days, two, 3 months of lockdown, a first wave, then another wave of lockdowns. So we had a very low productivity-led construction sector. So construction sector was affected heavily, and you could see lines of people going back to their rural hinterlands for agriculture work. Then there was this aviation sector. So because there was no travel, so all the flights were cancelled. So that was really hard. And I think the last sector which was affected was, I can say, public transport. Because you have no work, most work from home was happening. So one of the sectors which really was affected because public transport, railways in India, let's say public utilities like metros. So like in the world, it's slowly emerging back since last 2 years. So people have some semblance. So hospitality is back to pre-pandemic level. Aviation is back. We do see a lot of construction happening. So infrastructure projects dedicated, let's say, freight corridor in India, it's coming back.
Mr. Goglani, today the South Asian country is struggling with a widening trade deficit, dwindling currency, soaring inflation and other issues. So could you tell us what has gone wrong?
Like across the world, because it was a 2 years of pandemic, so we had a lot of, let's say, supply side disruptions. So I see, let's say, the dwindling rupee, the trade deficits and all these things in two major categories. First is the international factor. So we had, let's say, 2 years of supply side shocks. You had, let's say, semiconductors and chips were not working. So automobile sector, which was also hit hardest. So that was one of the all electronics were hit hard. Second, we all know the unfortunate Russian-Ukraine conflict that has totally disrupted the, let's say, the energy, oil prices and crude prices. And India imports 85% of its, let's say, crude resources from the world. So that's one of the major factors which has done this. And also, you can see, because there was this liquidity trap, which, let's say, last financial conditions were worsening, we could see some sort of Fed in the US taking back and the liquidity, which was excess liquidity, which was provided during the pandemic, the excess kind of stimulus was taken back. That created, because India relies heavily on FDI inflows, that would, so we saw a lot, let's say, a periodic 2 to 3 years of FDI on FPI inflows going back. The outflows were happening. And let's say these were the international factors. These were the larger systematic factors which has affected countries around the world.
Mr. Goglani, India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman attributes the fall of the rupee to external factors like the Russia-Ukraine war, rising crude oil prices and worsening global financial conditions. So what's your take on this?
Mehdi, I do concur largely with Minister Sitharaman. Because we are very heavy, let's say, oil and gas dependent country, our imports are 85%. We are dependent on crude prices and everything. So the actual trade deficit got worsened. So I have this one fact. So if you look at quarter two of 2021, our, let's say, the spending on oil was $25 billion. But if you see the quarter two of this year, it has gone up to $45 billion. So that kind of trade deficit is directly linked with this change in, let's say, the oil prices, which is almost like $100 right now. Another reason, which I also mentioned in my last intervention, was this. Because a lot of let's say global financial recession at US, we might see, because India relies heavily on, let's say, the software exports. So if you look at the trade deficit, or let's say the full balance of payments basket in India, we have surplus in, let's say, invisibles. We export, software, pharma, which helps us. And we also import this kind of oil and gold and other minerals and all from. So in that sense, because the market of oil has disrupted, this has changed our, let's say, balance of payments. And also, because there's this global recession, as you see in US, we might see some sort of cuts in our exports as well. So in that way, I do concur that largely our trade deficit and, let's say, depreciation of rupee is due to external factors.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Guglani, public policy researcher from New Delhi, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Javier Shergill, a Congress Party spokesman and Supreme Court lawyer, questions the Modi government's economic policy at a time when India's trade deficit has jumped with increasing imports and decreasing exports, urging the government to act to revive business. A member of India's parliament, Jawahar Sirkar, points to India's dependence on China by noting that imports have reached almost $100 billion, while exports remain less than a quarter of it. Pargat Singh, a sportsperson turned politician, says galloping inflation and rising fuel prices are making life miserable for the ordinary people in India, sharing pictures of a protest against fuel prices.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
For the Muslims in Kashmir, Muharram commemorations have always been central to their faith. People have offered blood, sweat and tears to keep the tradition of mourning for the martyrs of Karbala alive. From the first Islamic missionaries that came to Kashmir from Iran more than four centuries ago till today, the tradition of Azadari in the Himalayan region has tremendously evolved and gained popularity, playing a pivotal role in preserving the distinct identity of Kashmiri Shias.
According to historians, Azadari in Muharram was popularized in Kashmir by Sayyid Ali Hamadani, the Sufi luminary who came to Kashmir from Iran in the 14th century. A staunch lover of Ahlul Bayt, he is believed to have brought many symbols of heritage from Karbala. The popularity of Persian Noahs in Kashmir is largely attributed to him. Another important figure is Sayyid Shamsuddin Araqi, who also came from Iran. During his time, the practice of Muharram commemorations became widespread in Kashmir. Until then, people would do Azadari inside bungalows owned by Shia aristocrats. He built the first Hosseiniya in Srinagar that in later centuries emerged as a symbol of Shia resilience.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
During the Chalk rule in the 16th century, Kashmiri elegies gained unprecedented prominence and Azadari expanded far and wide. However, after the fall of Shia Chalks, the dark period started for Kashmiri Shias during the rule of Mughals and Afghans, when Muharram gatherings went underground. Shias were attacked and looted more than a dozen times, and the historic Hosseiniyah at Zadibal Srinagar was also razed to the ground many times. During the Dogra rule in the 19th century, the first Muharram procession was taken out during the daytime in Kashmir. In 1989, the procession was banned by the government, citing a law and order problem, even though the processions are totally peaceful.
The trials and tribulations continue for Shia Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir. For the past 32 years, traditional Muharram processions in Srinagar, the summer capital of the region, remain banned. Heavy restrictions are imposed every year on Muharram 8 and 10 in the city centre amid large deployment of troops. Like every year, this year too, mourners defied the government crackdown to take out peaceful processions. And like every year, security personnel resorted to force to disperse the processions and manhandle the mourners.
This year, two Muharram processions in the summer capital of Kashmir were broken up by security forces using unwarranted force. Young mourners were brutally beaten and manhandled. The government ban on traditional Muharram 8 and 10 processions remains in place since 1989, when the armed rebellion against Indian rule in the contested Himalayan region gained momentum.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussein slogans.
Each year, curfew-like restrictions are imposed in parts of the city. Iron barricades and spools of concertina wires are put up at every entry point. However, mourners defy the crackdown each year and take out peaceful mourning processions in the city. Each time, they are intercepted by large contingent of police and paramilitary forces who resort to baton charge and arrest the mourners.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept a ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
Muslims in Kashmir have been demanding revocation of the draconian ban, which they see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom and denial of fundamental human rights. They point to double standards of the government, which provides patronage and support for the annual Amarnath Yatra of Hindus, but denies the same right to Kashmiri Shias. There has been a long-running legal battle against the ban led by Kashmiri-based Shia organizations, but nothing has come out of it.
Now, to talk on this, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Isar Mehdi. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mehdi. Now, Kashmir has a rich socio-cultural history, and the tradition of Muharram commemorations date back many centuries. Can you briefly tell us how this tradition evolved in the region over the past years?
This is a very interesting question. Muharram is the month in which the beloved grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Hussain, was martyred, along with his family and friends, in the desert of Karbala, by the tyrant called Yazid. Every year, around this time, massive processions take place across the world and also in Kashmir to pay rich tribute to martyr of Karbala. But in Kashmir, what happens that both the communities, the majority community and also the minority community, they come together and commemorate these processions. In Kashmir, it started in 1527 when Sultan Muhammad Shah was the ruler. And during that time, Shia Muslims, along with the Sunni Muslims, used to commemorate these processions together. And there were two major processions that were taken out from Kashmir. One from Nimach Bal to Imam Bara Zadibal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushal Sar. Both these processions were basically taken out by Shias and Sunnis together. And also in 1977, when Sheikh Abdullah was the chief minister, he was also, because of his request, there was a joint procession taken out by both the communities. from Abi Guzar to Zadibar, which is basically in Imambara. But what happened in 90s, in late 90s, what happened, the wave of militancy took over Kashmir. And at that time, the governor of the JNK imposed ban on the procession as a sweeping measure to deal with the political unrest. But after that, nothing happened. The ban was not lifted. And it still remains in the state.
Mr. Mehdi, what elements of Muharram commemorations are unique to Kashmir? And also, can you tell us a bit about Kashmiri Marsiyas, which are integral to these commemorations?
Marsiyas are very unique in Kashmir, and they have served a purpose of basically safeguarding Shia identity in Kashmir. Shia identity and Marsiya are they are basically hand and glove. What they have done, what Marsiya has done basically, they have basically survived Shia identity. Marsiya is a unique feature to Kashmiri Shia identity, and because of the Marsiya, Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein has survived and has lived from generation to generation. Marsiya has basically four important parts. The first part is that's called Hamd. In Hamd, what you do, you praise Allah. Second part is basically Naat. What you do, you praise Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And then there's third part that's called Madah. In Madah, what you do, you praise Imam Ali al-Islam. You glorify him. And then there's last part where you should reveal the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. You show that how Imam Hussein Islam gave his blood to tell the world that to never follow the dictates of an oppressor. You basically reveal that how Imam Hussein Islam offered a peerless sacrifice in Karbala only to uphold human values, and eventually gave his head, not hand, to set an example for the world that give away everything but never buckle before a tyrant.
Mr. Mehdi, in many parts of the Muslim majority region, we have seen Shias and Sunnis together taking part in Muharram processions and events. Now, could you say Azadari is a thread that binds the two communities together?
Obviously. If we look at the event of Karbala itself, you will see that this whole episode of Karbala, there are voices of unity. Karbala has that glue within it. Even in fact, in Kashmir, you will see, as I said earlier, that Kashmiris use it to take processions together. Both majority and minority community use it to perform, use it to, you know, basically take out these processions together. As I said, in 1527, when Sultan Muhammad Shah was the ruler, Shia Muslims, who are the minority, used to take the procession with the Sunni majority together. In fact, there were two processions, as I said, from Nemechbal to Imambara Zadipal, and the other from Alamgiri Bazar to Kushalsar. Both were taken by Shia and Sunni communities together.
Thank you, Mr. Mehdi, for being on the program. He's a religious scholar at South Asian University in New Delhi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Saqib Mughlu, a Kashmiri journalist, says while the world grapples with sectarianism and extremism, Kashmiris continue to set examples of Shia-Sunni brotherhood, sharing a picture of Sunnis providing beverages and food items to Shia mourners. Kargil-based political activist Sajjad Kargili, pointing to double standards on religious freedom, notes that while Muharram processions are allowed across India, in Kashmir they are banned by the government.
And that was our episode about the economic crisis facing India and the traditional Muharram commemorations in Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
American voters on tribal lands are more than twice as likely to face removal. Stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Kevin Morris and Peter Miller and Brennan Center for Justice. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Non-White Voters Face High Risk of Being Dropped from Arizona's Mail Ballot List. Here's more. The past year has been characterized by widespread assaults on voting rights across the U.S. This has been especially true in swing states where the 2020 presidential election saw narrow margins. As Will Wilder, journalist, explains, even among these states, Arizona stands out as a focal point for the fight over voting rights. In the U.S., we look at one provision of Arizona Senate Bill 1485, which was passed into law in May 2021, but won't be in effect for the midterms. The bill turns Arizona's extremely popular permanent early voting list into an active early voting list. Voters on the list are automatically mailed a ballot before every election. Under the new rules, Arizonans will be removed from the list if they go 4 years without casting a ballot by mail. Even if a voter participates, but only does so in person, they will fall off the list. Like in much of the western United States, Arizonans have a robust history of casting their votes by mail. Since 2010, an average of 2/3 of the electorate has voted by mail. Like 4 other states, Arizona has allowed voters to sign up to receive a ballot in the mail for all elections, obviating the need to fill out a new